It's Friday, March 26th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Tough Questions with Suzanne Nossel. This week, tech CEOs head to Capitol Hill. An investigation shows police nationwide were unprepared for last summer's surge of protests and a death threat against a top UN official. Then, your voice is your superpower. Our Jonathan Friedman interviews children's book author and media lawyer Jessica Borer about how to raise up the next generation of free speech defenders. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on The Pen Pod. If it's Friday, it's time for Tough Questions, where we ask the most pressing questions about free speech to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Stephen.
So I want to start with the tech companies. Yesterday, the CEOs of Facebook, Twitter, and Google were grilled by members of Congress about the scourge of disinformation, in particular, how it did or did not lead to the Capitol Hill insurgency that we saw just before the inauguration. I mean, at one point, Suzanne, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, pushed back the head of Facebook and said, look, you know, we're not, our algorithms aren't designed to juice attention spans, and we're not the only people who are, you know, putting up platforms that disinformation gets traded on. People are on messaging apps and they're watching cable news. Does he have a point? Are we spending too much time focusing on Twitter, Facebook, and Google and not all the other places where disinformation flourishes?
Look, I don't think there is any single silver bullet, but I also think it's not terribly credible for Zuckerberg or other social media CEOs to try to deflect attention from the role they play. I thought one of the things that was striking about today's hearing was the degree to which members really zeroed in on the algorithms and how the platforms are set up and designed to propagate. It's not just hatred, but it's content that deeply engages, that sort of incenses people, that riles people up, that people feel compelled by. And, you know, some of that's completely harmless celebrity content. It can be, in memoriams for people who have died young. You know, there are all sorts of types of content that can really move around, obviously memes and funny things. But among that subset of, you know, what goes viral, yeah, we have learned time and again are in the incendiary forms of disinformation, vitriol, and other types of content that can cause real world harms when they propagate. And so I thought surfacing that was very important. You know, so much of the conversation is about whether certain content should be taken down or left up. And that's really only sort of scratches the surface of the problem. The real question is, you know, what moves around the network and how? You know, that said, that's not the totality of the issue when it comes to disinformation. There was a very important study published last year out of Harvard about how the mainstream media played an absolutely critical role in propagating disinformation during during the pre-election period with Donald Trump. You know, he would make news saying something outrageous and false, and it would be covered because he was the president. And once they covered it, it would become a huge subject for discussion on social media. It would wend its way into, you know, private messaging services and closed Facebook groups. And so, you know, it's an ecosystem, a dysfunctional, kind of polluted ecosystem. You know, within that ecosystem, among the most powerful actors, no question about it, are the social media companies. So I think getting into the guts of how they operate and what they elevate and amplify is critical to ultimately, you know, getting a handle on the scourge of disinformation.
Yeah, well, let's pivot a bit to a pretty troubling piece of reporting this week in the New York Times. You know, this past summer, of course, with the surge in demonstrations protesting anti-Black racism, there have been more than a dozen what are known as after-action evaluations of police responses to those demonstrations. And they show a pretty alarming trend that police were poorly trained, heavily militarized, and really unprepared for the thousands of people who turned out on the streets in at least 9 major American cities. You know, what does that tell you about the state of protest and First Amendment rights in America when the police don't know how to respond to it?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, one of the issues is sort of a practical one, which is that these mass movements only, arise and erupt from time to time. And so the daily work that's going on in most of these departments, you know, really doesn't have much resemblance to what's called public order policing. And so, you know, these are sort of emergency situations. And I think the, you know, question is, like, you know, in any profession, you know, what are the preparations, what kicks into gear when you get into a kind of crisis? It may only happen once every 5 years or 10 years, but you need a protocol. People need to be, you know, they need to be doing drills. People need a certain level of familiarity. And then there have to be core teams that, you know, really are schooled in this stuff and up to date and can step up into positions of responsibility and leadership, you know, when these mass public order events happen, something like the, you know, on the order of the Black Lives Matter protests, or, you know, there've been other, the Ferguson protests several years ago. And, you know, there's some dynamics here that exacerbated matters. You know, there are studies showing that when protest is about the topic of police brutality or excesses, as was the case over the summer, that the cops react differently than if the protest is about, you know, the environment or women's rights or another subject, that they're more defensive, probably more trigger happy, you know, that they take it more personally, perhaps at some level, understandably. So I think that's something that we also need to be preparing our police for. I thought one of the observations in the write-up was interesting about the need for greater communication and collaboration between organizers and police. It brought me back to early days of my career when I was working in South Africa during the transition from apartheid. And I was involved in the townships and dealing with political violence in the run-up to the election. And the violence almost invariably would erupt at these mass protests. And what we developed was a very intensive protocol, actually, of collaboration between the organizers of the protests, the political parties, the civic groups, the unions, and the police. And there would be planning ahead of time about what was going to be the route of the march, where were people going to go. People were in contact with each other during these marches to try to troubleshoot such combustible situations as they arose. And it ended up being pretty effective. And so it's sort of striking that that type of cooperation does not seem to exist. And, you know, I suppose there it grew out of, there was a pattern, you know, that was truly deadly. And, you know, that's what motivated both sides to want to come to the table and work out, you know, a way for protest rights to be exercised without people losing their lives. And, you know, perhaps, you know, the disruptions of last summer are enough to get us to that point, but probably depends a little bit on, you know, who's doing the organizing next time and whether, you know, any relationships have been built ahead of time or can be built in real time.
Yeah. Well, finally, Suzanne, from the U.S. to South Africa to Saudi Arabia, reported this week that a top Saudi official issued an effective death threat against the UN investigator who examined the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Agnes Callamard had concluded, as you know from her report, that Khashoggi had been killed at the behest of the Saudi crown prince. This seems to be impunity run amok. You know, you're a former diplomat. You worked at the United Nations. How beyond the pale is this?
You know, it's hard to know what to say about such a horrific revelation that someone, you know, this is somebody who has devoted her life to human rights. She ran Article 19. She's going to be running Amnesty International. You know, when so many governments were looking the other way and sitting on their hands in the wake of the murder, she stepped up and used her mandate as a UN special rapporteur to take up the mantle and mount an investigation, you know, at a moment when really no one else was willing to do so. And it was very brave of her. It was, you know, a service to humanity. And, you know, the idea that, I mean, it's, you know, this Saudi official who is, you know, was seeking to plot against her, you know, has a title of, you know, a human rights chief in Saudi Arabia. So it just makes an absolute, you know, mockery. It's shambolic. You know, if the administration sort of thinks it's enough to stop short of MBS, I think, you know, a revelation like this just really underscores the depths to which that regime is prepared to go to silence, you know, not just critics, but, you know, here's someone who is investigating the murder of a critic. And so I think it's profoundly disturbing, and it really underscores the imperative of the Biden administration using its leverage to try to force change. That's not going to be easy. You know, we had that discussion in the hearing last week on human rights in Saudi Arabia, but there were several points of leverage brought up. And, you know, I think this just really underlines the imperative there.
Well, we'll leave it there. Suzanne Nossel, she's CEO of PEN America and author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks a lot, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Now, a new children's book meant to bring up the next generation of free speech allies. PEN America's Jonathan Friedman has that conversation.
Jessica Borer has been protecting and empowering journalists for over a decade. She is vice president and editorial counsel in the newsroom at Forbes, and she also serves on the leadership council of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Along with her father, Sandy, who is a First Amendment lawyer, she recently published a children's book titled Your Voice is Your Superpower, A Beginner's Guide to Free Speech and the First Amendment. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me about the book. What did you want to achieve with it? And how did the idea come about?
So my dad and I are both First Amendment lawyers who spend most of our days working with journalists to protect their rights to free speech and freedom of the press. And we got to talking about the question of when people learn about the rights of freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and when in your childhood or adulthood, do you really come to value something like free speech? And we thought it would be a really fun idea to talk to young children about freedom of speech and frame it in the prism of using your voice, and your voice can be your superpower. So we decided to write a children's book about the importance of freedom of speech and the power in using your voices, in the hopes that we can start children at a very young age, both understanding what freedom of speech is and also valuing the importance of protecting it. And so that's what ended up becoming Your Voice is Your Superpower. And it's been a really neat project to work on together.
Well, tell me more. How has it been received? You've been promoting the book in schools, among teachers and librarians.
We have. It's been really neat. Of course, because of the pandemic, we aren't able to meet with our readers in real life. So we've been doing events via Zoom and Meet and all of the interactive apps. But it's been really amazing to interact with the readers from usually about kindergarten age to third grade, both in classrooms and in libraries. And so we've done a whole bunch of them around the country. In fact, last weekend we just taped a reading and an art activity with the local library in my neighborhood in Miami, Florida. So it was really neat, but it's amazing to be face-to-face with the readers, to see their faces when they're hearing you read the book, and to hear the impact that the messages in the book has on them. So I had a reader who said to me that she used to be really shy, but after reading Your Voice is Your Superpower, she felt really empowered and strong and was excited to use her voice. And that's the kind of experience we were hoping to get when we wrote the book, to make kids feel empowered and to make them really understand the value of protecting the rights to free speech. But so the interactive experiences have been really amazing.
Wow, it sounds it. And I love that story of empowerment. Now, your father is a First Amendment lawyer. You've certainly have some knowledge of First Amendment cases. It seems tremendously complicated for young children. You know, what do you say to those who think that kindergarten is really just too young to learn about the First Amendment?
I think it's a tough concept, certainly for children and adults in some respects. But when we talk to young children, so kindergarten, you're talking about 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, we talked to them about rules, right? So we talked to them about rules in their house and in their classroom and in libraries. And when they go out into the world, they know there are rules. And so we kind of frame it like the First Amendment is one of those rules. And what's so great about it is it gives us this amazing power, right? This amazing opportunity to use our voices. And so we don't focus on the language of the amendment itself and the Constitution so much as the spirit that's behind it. And so we really focus on giving the readers, the children, and their parents, frankly, a lot of tangible examples of ways they can use their voice. And in fact, also the concept that they don't actually always have to use their voice. Sometimes it's important to just have the space to be quiet and to listen. And so we're trying to really give the message that everyone has a voice and there's so many ways to use that voice. And we want them to feel empowered and respectful of other voices. And so I think that what we found, especially in the classrooms, as well as the libraries actually, is that that's a really challenging topic for little kids, but it's so important. You know, when you're in you're starting your first years in informal schooling, you're interacting with lots of kids, you're interacting with teachers and librarians and administrators. And so being able to find the right way to express yourself is just a really important tool. And I think the message really resonates, I hope, with both, you know, the youngest students who are reading the book. And as I said, their family members, their parents, their guardians that are around. So we can have better communication. And I'm sure you've seen, you know, we know that the climate that these kids are growing up with and in is often one of conflict. And they see grownups that are having trouble talking to people that they disagree with and being good listeners and allowing other people that they disagree with the space to, you know, share their feelings and their opinions. So it's an amazing tool, I think. To start working on at an early age instead of waiting until you're, you know, like in college or out there in the professional world.
Oh, absolutely. I've done a lot of work with college campuses in the past few years, precisely on the issues you're talking about, not just empowering people to use their voices, but understanding the importance of respecting when other people are using their voices too. I think there aren't a lot of models, as you said, in the political sphere and in other areas for young people and certainly for teenagers now to look at and see respectful dialogue. So it's certainly a politicized and polarized issue across the country. Have you had any negative responses from teachers who are concerned about how they can effectively broach these topics in schools?
Well, we haven't had negative feedback, but I've certainly had teachers who said that they have students that maybe have a kind of an outlier of a viewpoint from the majority of their class and that they struggle with how to get all of the kids to be respectful of each other's voices and opinions and feelings. And so I definitely have had conversations with teachers before we set up our actual classroom visit, talking about ways we can emphasize, just as you're saying, college students have trouble with this. Little kids have trouble with it. Grownups have trouble with it. Listening to people we don't agree with is hard, right? It's not always easy, especially when it's something we care about very much. But I think it's a great space to talk about that. When we're talking about the book itself, we use that as kind of like a nice jumping off point and then let the kids sort of take it where they want to go. I mean, I think, you know, when we launched the book, it was also right before the election. So a lot of the children are experiencing the events happening in the United States in particular. They're hearing people talk about the election. They're hearing people talk about different viewpoints. A lot of it's heated. Maybe they're going to protests. Maybe they're hearing their parents upset about what's happening in the news. You know, it's a really heated and emotional time. So I think it's been a nice moment to have this conversation with kids and students in that setting. But certainly it's challenging. But I think I'm very sympathetic to that challenge of when there's one kid in the class who maybe comes from a different perspective. You know, and believe it or not, of course, like kindergarten students can have political views too. You know, they can disagree on things.
Oh, like absolutely.
The environment, the government, decisions in their school, the way families should operate, all the things that adults think about, you know, a lot of them children are thinking about too. But that's definitely the most challenging, I think, aspect of freedom of speech that I encounter with our young readers, and I think with adults in the real world as a free speech advocate and a free speech lawyer. I think, you know, that's often the most challenging piece of it.
Oh, absolutely. The kids certainly have political opinions, and they're trying to make sense of the world. I think this book offers one way to help them do that, as you're describing. And, you know, they haven't been sheltered. They're seeing these things going on in their lives. They're seeing what their parents are talking about. They're listening all the time. So having a way to broach those topics for teachers in schools, to me, seems like a real asset.
Thank you. Me too. And I think also to build on that, one of the points that has been interesting to bring home with some of these children is that using your voice doesn't necessarily mean speaking and talking with your mouth out loud, that there are lots of other ways to express things you care about and what's meaningful to you, what makes you feel good, what makes you feel bad. And so I think that has been empowering, especially when I see some of the students who are a little bit more shy and don't think of themselves as super vocal. We've been able to show them some examples of ways you can express yourself, whether that's in what you wear, something symbolic, or a practice you do at home or outside of the home, whether it's religious or other kind of cultural tradition, or whether it's writing a letter or a poem or creating a poster that you put in your window and people see when they, you know, drive or walk by your house or your apartment. And so that's been really nice because I think children feel in this environment probably also sometimes like a little bit of pressure that they have to be or act or express themselves in a certain way, either to fit in or to stand out. And I think one thing I hope we're doing in our readings and interactions with our kids and readers is making them feel empowered to find their own way to express themselves and to let others do that too.
And you've developed some materials, some resources, a guide for teachers to complement the book. That's right.
We have, yes. We have a PDF full of educational activities that teachers can use, parents can use at home, librarians. I know some of them have used them too. It has a bunch of tangible exercises to do kind of either as an exercise they do before we come in and do a reading, or just independently after a reading, or you know, when they're at home. And so those exercises include everything from writing a letter to the president, the vice president, your mayor, your principal, or someone else who you look up to about something that you care about, to making your own poster to either bring to a protest or put up in your house or on your lawn, and even making a cape. Because our book actually talks about the fact that some superheroes wear capes, but of course you don't need a cape to be a superhero. I find that a lot of young kids, they really like wearing capes to be superheroes. So that's been a fun one too. And so we encourage them to draw and write and create something that feels symbolic of an issue or a person that they care about. And that's been really fun to see how they use those resources.
It sounds like a great way of engaging young people in particular. Who doesn't want to wear a cape and think of their voice as a superpower all the time? Now, finally, just wanted to ask, you know, for your career, you know, you've done all of this work protecting and empowering journalists. How does this book fit into the work that you're up to otherwise on a day-to-day basis?
Well, two ways. You know, one is that as someone who works day to day protecting and empowering journalists and working for the right to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, I have a vested interest in more people growing up believing in those principles and those values. So, you know, the first reason we wrote the book, of course, is that we want to hopefully inspire more of the next generations to value freedom of speech and the First Amendment and all of the things that come with it. So, you know, that's really the first goal. And the connection to my work is that I work with journalists who are exercising those rights and frankly, whose rights are in danger almost every day, given the current climate. So we're hoping to inspire more people who believe in it and generations who will feel motivated to stand up to protect it. And then the second connection is that, as you said, I do some advisory work and I also am on the Leadership Council of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And because I feel so strongly about the important work they do, we're donating a portion of the proceeds from Your Voice is Your Superpower to the Committee to Protect Journalists. So that's been a nice connection for us. We're happy to be able to support them in any way that we can.
Well, it sounds very foundational and, as I said, a great asset for teachers and parents and librarians and others who are trying to explain these issues to young people and, as you said, inspire them to be supporters of free speech and respectful exchange. Jessica, thanks so much for being here. That's children's author Jessica Borer. The book is Your Voice is Your Superpower from Simon & Schuster. Jessica, thanks so much for being here.
And that's our episode for Friday, March 26th. Join us next Friday for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you next week.